This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, the Reverend John C. Welch, chairman of the board for the Gamaliel Foundation, dean of students at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary, and the keynote speaker for this year's Isaac Banquet this weekend in Kalamazoo. But first, State Representative Dave Maturin was elected to the state legislature for the first time in November. The Republican represents parts of Kalamazoo and Calhoun counties in the 63rd State House District. Dave Maturin, thank you very much for being here.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here today.
Let's begin with, I think, the topic that's on the minds of many voters right now, a couple months basically from an election that's going to decide the future of roads in this state. What would you say voters can expect if the increase in the sales tax is rejected on May 5th?
Well, I think you could expect to see 148 different Plan Bs come out on May 6th, I believe is the day after the election. That's 110 senators and 110 representatives, excuse me, and 38 senators. I wasn't privy to all the discussion that went on the last fall at the end of the year, at the end of the session.
Because you were not elected yet.
I was not elected, right. I was just, you know, kind of off on the sidelines watching it all. But there really isn't any Plan B right now. I can tell you that from sitting on the Transportation Committee. I think everybody probably in the back of their mind has some thoughts, but as much time as it took to put together Proposal 1, it'll be interesting to see how quickly we could come up with something else that would, again, solve a road problem that's still going to exist.
If a constituent were to contact you and ask your opinion and whether or not they should support it, would you tell them to vote for Proposal 1?
You know, I kind of, since I wasn't involved in the discussion, I kind of look at my position as one of informing people as to what the issue deals with, how we fund our roads today, and what the proposal, what it does for roads and what it does for the other parts of what some people are calling a Christmas tree that exists with Proposal 1. I got one vote out of hopefully a million or so. So however I vote really is immaterial. I kind of look at my position as a state representative being informative.
You don't care to share with us how you plan to vote?
Not at this point, no.
Should the legislature, and specifically the Transportation Committee, be starting to work on Plan B and at least give voters a chance to see what may be coming or what the alternative may be if they don't approve Proposal 1 in May?
Well, I don't think it's a good idea because whatever the House Transportation Committee would come up with may be wildly different from what the ultimate package would be. I mean, you can see what happened last time. The Senate and the governor agreed entirely on a wholesale tax, and the House disagreed completely. So we have what we have now. So I think, you know, indicating there's a plan out there is just one more reason for folks to vote no and see what's on the other side. So I think we'd be doing a disfavor to the people that put this on the ballot, even thinking that we even had a plan out there. We don't.
But if you look at history, there was an increase in the sales tax, which was approved by voters in 1994 as part of what's now known as Proposal A. And that was approved instead of an increase in the income tax. That was sort of the Plan B at that time if Proposal A had not passed. Could something like that work now?
Well, first of all, it's too late. If that was the case, they should have done it when they put Proposal 1 on the ballot. They should have been, if they wanted to use that approach to it. Obviously, going back to 92 with Proposal C and then 94 with Proposal A, which is basically a warmed over C, you know, there was an option, an alternate. If you don't vote for the sales tax increase and a property tax reduction, you end up getting an income tax increase. If they wanted, the governor and the parties wanted to put that together, they should have done it then to say, okay, here's Plan A. If you don't like that, you get Plan B automatically. They didn't for whatever reason. I'm not going to second guess them. It's certainly way too, there's certainly not enough time now to even think about that.
Speaking of taxes, there's about over $9 billion in outstanding tax credits that companies could cash in over the next 15, 16 years or so. Should the state be looking at some way to scale that back or limit it or spread the payments out over a longer period of time? Do any of those options sound good to you?
Well, I think the fact of the matter is the problem is that it first looked to us and sitting on the vice chair of the Tax Policy Committee, we did have the folks from MEDC and Treasury come in. It started out to be roughly 4 or 5 billion, and by the time we finally got to the end numbers, it's around 10 billion. And the problem is more of a matter of timing. We have absolutely no idea when these credits are going to be turned in. The state was kind of surprised to see 200 million worth of reductions we had to make in the existing fiscal year, and another half a billion coming up. To the best of my knowledge, they're contracts. We can't get out of them. But I think we the administration, someone can talk to the folks that hold these contracts and say, look, we really need some idea what certainty is going to be. That way we can at least plan for it instead of finding out in the middle of a fiscal year that we're $200 million short, or having to plan to take a half a billion out of our general fund, roughly $10 billion, for the next year. So I would hope that somebody's talking to the businesses that do hold these and say, look, it's a pretty good deal for you. Is there some way we can limit the amount you can do in a single year, or have some better idea of how to plan for this? I think that the unknown is the thing that's really bad out there. We know the total amount. We just have no idea each year, you know, what the amounts are going to be. Should somebody have planned for that way back when they did it? That's my predecessors. Perhaps I should have. But I think there's got to be some attempt at getting some sort of certainty within a range as to how many of these credits are going to be redeemed each year.
Well, $10 billion is a lot of money. Spread out over 16 years is one thing. What if you could spread it out further, even if you had to spend a little more? That was basically Representative Miller's idea when he was in here, is maybe we sweeten it a little bit, but we extend it out so we're amortizing the amount that we have to pay over time. Would you want to look at something like that?
I think I'd look at anything that would give us some certainty. And if you're looking at spreading it out, then obviously, you know, the whole aspect of time value of money, it may not cost you more in the end, depending upon how you want to discount those things back to today's value.
There's also a proposal in the state house that would more or less bring an end to the credits for film and television production in Michigan. Do you support that?
Yes, I do. I voted for it as vice chair of tax policy. We had the folks testify before our House Tax Policy Committee and found that the arguments in favor of eliminating it outweighed any arguments that opposed it.
The Senate Majority Leader, Arlen Meekhoff, however, is saying that he's not necessarily enthusiastic about this, and he says that there are promises we've made to people, i.e., looks upon some of these as contracts, what you said about tax credits. Does he have a point about, you know, some certainty for these businesses which might try to claim tax credits?
Well, I think if we've got a contractual obligation like we did under the mega credits, that's one thing. I'm not sure if we have a contractual obligation for any film entity, unless if we come to a contract with somebody, they should anticipate getting those credits if they made the expenditures under the existing law. But I don't recall there being anything. I mean, to me, it's a pot of money out there, and if you're first in line, you can take advantage of it because they are limited. At least at this point, in the governor's budget to $50 million. So I'm not quite sure if you can compare contracts under MEGA with kind of a first-come, first-serve at a limited pot of money with film credits.
There have been a series of gun law reforms which have been approved. Governor Snyder most recently signed legislation that abolishes county gun boards. Does the state need any further changes in policy and regulations surrounding firearms?
Wow, I don't know. There's always a push for changes in it. I guess I'd have to take a look at whatever somebody might bring up and weigh that with what we have currently, what safeguards there are, what policies schools or other entities may have regarding firearms. But what we just did the other day and what the governor just signed was something that pretty much made it truly a shall issue state. And I think we're one of 47 states that has that as an aspect for having a concealed weapon.
Is being a shall issue state where we should be? Is that the right way to go?
Well, that effectively is what it is. I mean, that we've been a shall issue state for a while. It just pretty much affirms the fact that if you qualify, if you check the boxes, you don't have a criminal record to whatever degree, then you automatically get one.
Do you think there was any value, though, in having county gun boards that might be one more check on somebody getting a gun who perhaps is not someone we, as a society, would prefer having one?
Well, you know, I think that was part of the reasons the folks that opposed it came up with, but I'm not sure if law enforcement knows every single individual in the county, every single individual that applies for one. And even if they did know something about those people, they still had to fit the criteria of the CPL law. And I think that was pretty specific. So it seemed the argument, there were several counties that it was very difficult to get a concealed weapon permit, and they were asking really questions that really weren't germane to the actual statute itself.
Let's talk a little bit about energy policy. Representative Eric Nesbitt has proposed some changes and reforms. There's some different facets here. If you're on the Energy Committee yourself, can you give me your blueprint of what you would like to see Michigan do with energy going forward?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm in the discovery stage. I know Representative Nesbitt just put forth his several sets of bills, the way he'd like to see the energy policy going forward. Governor's got something coming out, I believe, this week. And Senator Knopf will be coming out with something relatively soon. You know, it's interesting. I have people come into my office. They sit down. They're on one side of the issue, and there's more than one side of this issue. It's like a six or seven different sides of the issue. And they come in, and they all have very plausible arguments, and they all have documentation, they all have studies, and they all conflict with each other. And yet they all have the answer. And I guess right now I'm trying to gain as much knowledge as I can. Some folks want 100% choice. Representative Nesbitt's bill says zero choice. So right now we have a 10% choice. Some folks want to expand the renewable portfolio standard. I think his bill keeps it at 10%. Other folks don't want any new power plants. They think we can do it all with energy savings and renewable energy. There's all sorts of ways of looking at this thing. And I guess at this particular point, I'm trying to just wade through all of it and see what makes the most sense for affordability, reliability, sustainability for our energy future here in Michigan.
Some conservative groups have questioned why there is a lack of competition in this plan. Would you like to see some competition in the market? Do you think it would help?
You know, that's one of those issues. You got folks that are calling for 100% choice, where there isn't any limit on the amount of choice you can get. I guess a big issue is the fact that if you are going to have folks build a power plant in Michigan, you know, I'm not going to spend 4 years and billions of dollars building a power plant without knowing I can sell that energy to somebody. So I think from a practical standpoint, if you believe that we need energy generation here in Michigan and not be dependent on outside sources, and it's more complex than that because you got the Mid-Continent Inter-Service Organization, MISO, that puts all of the connectivity from states, from us down to Louisiana, all together in this one big grid. I mean, that's another issue. But, you know, if you're going to have generation here, then people are going to want to have customers. And it's pretty hard to encourage anybody to put that much money into a facility and not have some sort of a reasonably guaranteed return, which means people using the power you produce.
You've introduced a resolution which is urging the Defense Department to select Fort Custer as the site for a missile defense mission. What do you think this would bring to the region if Fort Custer does get picked?
Well, I think it would, I think fit nicely into the community. The community has always been supportive of the efforts at Fort Custer back when they had the A-10s there, the drone mission. Obviously, it would be an economic plus for the area, having the jobs and just the tremendous amount of capital that would go into that facility. But I think we got a good location. I think it's something that is key to our national defense. And if we can certainly benefit from it, I mean, the region would benefit, not just necessarily Fort Custer, which kind of lies, you know, part in Kalamazoo County and part in Calhoun County, part in the 63rd, part in the 62nd. But I think it would be a benefit to the entire region. And I would like to add the imprimatur of the state government, along with that of the county board, we passed a resolution last year, and other local units of government, just letting them know we really are desirous of having this here. You've got our support, and whatever we can do, you know, from an infrastructure basis or whatever, to make this happen, we want to be a willing partner.
You think there might be some things that have to be done infrastructure-wise if that's going to become a reality?
Well, you know, we got a good transportation system in I-94. We certainly have a very long airstrip there at the W.K. Kellogg Airport. So, you know, if things need to be done, you know, we'd like to be behind it.
Speaking of I-94, the Michigan Department of Transportation is doing a big comprehensive study of a long stretch of the highway, including that part that goes through eastern Kalamazoo County, that I know you must travel quite frequently. And a lot of people have raised concerns about how safe it is, especially after that huge accident we had on there back in January. What are you hoping that MDOT's going to be able to determine by taking a look at I-94?
Well, I'd like to see the study, see when it's done. We drive by that. We're in session 3 days a week, and I drive by it 3 days a week, unless I happen to stay overnight in Lansing, which is quite infrequent. I don't know if having a wider roadway there would have prevented that accident from occurring. I just think the conditions were such that, I mean, that very same day I was going up north, because I think it was a Friday, I was going up to Grand Rapids on 131, and the conditions were just about the same there with whiteouts. If you had a third lane, you may have had more cars involved. But I do think a stretch of road seems to get a lot of, just a lot more traffic between Battle Creek and Kalamazoo, and add in the truck traffic, and I think it's really a bottleneck in there. Lots of slow traffic, lots of people dodging around. I'd like to see it widened, but I also asked the MDOT director, Kurt Steidel, one of our transportation committee meetings, when that might occur, and he didn't have an answer. He said it depends on the federal funds, could easily be a decade. I guess whatever their study shows, it shows, but I'd caution people not to hold their breath waiting for that to be three lanes in each direction.
State Representative Dave Maturin, thank you for your time.
Welcome. My pleasure.
Dave Maturin represents the 63rd State House District. That includes parts of Kalamazoo and Calhoun counties. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The Reverend John C. Welch is chairman of the board of the Gamaliel Foundation based in Chicago. He's also the vice president and dean of students at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. Reverend Welch is the keynote speaker for this year's Isaac Banquet in Kalamazoo. Reverend Welch, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's introduce you a little bit to our audience by telling them about some of these organizations who you're involved with. Tell us about the Gamaliel Foundation.
Well, the Gamaliel Foundation has been around for almost 30 years now. And it is a network of affiliate organizations like Isaac in 17 different states. We have a little over 60 affiliate organizations. So the organization here in Pittsburgh, where I served as president for a few years, it's called the Pennsylvania Interfaith Impact Network. So we're a network of organizations that do congregational-based community organizing and leadership development.
The theme of this year's Isaac Banquet here in Kalamazoo is On the Road to Justice. From where you sit, how far have we traveled down that road to justice?
It's a very long road. And I wouldn't say we've made it very far. I think we've made it down the path of ways, but then we've seemed to have regressed a bit. But it's a very long road, so I think we have a very long ways to go.
What are some examples where you say we've regressed?
Well, just one clear example is after all of the work that was done throughout the civil rights movement for equality, and as evidenced in affirmative action practices that resulted from that work, we now find ourselves faced with states, institutions unraveling those policies and assuming that we have a fair playing field. And likewise, with the recent actions of the Supreme Court in challenging some of the statutes in the Voting Rights Act, again, assuming that we have a fair playing field. So much of the hard work of the civil rights leaders is now being called to question and is being challenged.
So if we're going to keep traveling down that road to justice, what are some things you would like to see done?
One of the things I think is going to be very important is to have a very well-educated electorate. And voter engagement is always going to be important. I think it's important for people on the ground to understand just how long-standing or the long-term ramifications of one's vote is. When you vote to put somebody in office, some of the policies that they approve or legislate can have significant ramifications for years, maybe even decades. So it's important that people are informed of the duties of the people who they elect and the impact that they can have on our well-being.
Is that maybe a little easier to do now than it was, say, we're speaking here on Friday, and it's right before the 50th anniversary of the March at Selma. And I'm wondering if you think it is a little easier now to educate and get information out to voters, given that there's more of a network of groups like some of the ones you're involved with, that there is technology which allows mass dissemination of information. Is it somewhat easier now to at least bring people up to speed on the issues?
There are fewer impediments, I think, than there were decades ago, but there is also an abundance of media outlets as well as different forms for which people can be informed. So I think the challenge is the integrity of the information that's being shared, and the onus on people to understand which sources to go to get credible information. So I think that's the 21st century challenge. So on the one hand, it's easier, but I think on the other hand, it can be a little bit more challenging.
How intertwined do you see issues of justice, economic justice and some of those things, education, and the issue of race? How tied are those things still together?
Oh, they're like Siamese twins. They're it's almost inseparable. Everything that we're dealing with these days still boils down to the race issue. And so, you know, one of the biggest fallacies to have been stated once President Obama was elected was that we're in a post-racial society, but evidence shows, particularly from the research of the Poverty Law Center, Southern Poverty Law Center, that once he was elected, gun sales increased, ammunition sales increased, hate crime groups increased. You know, so we're still dealing with a racialized society. And as it pertains to education and jobs, African Americans are the largest sector of the unemployed. We are the largest sector of the undereducated. We are the largest sector of the incarcerated. And those things are all intertwined. And so you have to look at the policies that have been created to perpetuate the impoverishment of African Americans and the undereducating by way of reducing resources in public schools and the high crime that we find in these impoverished communities. Some might want to say it's due to, you know, questionable character and behavior of those, but I think you also have to look at the conditions for which folks have been forced to live in. And we know that the whole idea of human instinct is going to be survival of the fittest. So if you don't provide jobs for folks, they're going to find other ways to get or to make money. And they seem to do that by way of selling drugs, which leads to incarceration, high incarceration rates, long sentencing. You know, the whole nine. So it's all intertwined with race.
Is the idea of a post-racial society attainable in, say, yours or my lifetime?
Well, that would assume that you know how old I am and I know how old you are.
Okay, I'm 47. Let's go with me for now.
I do have hope in that. You look at the millennial generation, for example. Many of them are not have not been spoiled by the toxicity of racism, so to speak. So with the whole Black Lives Matter movement as a result of Michael Brown and Eric Garner, there you saw a wide swatch of people of various ethnicities, blacks, whites, different ages. But the most important thing is the young college and high school kids are really moving, and they're not necessarily dividing themselves among racial lines, as many folks in our age group and before us have done.
It was 10 years ago this fall that there was a big announcement here in Kalamazoo, a program called the Kalamazoo Promise, which gives free college tuition to graduates of Kalamazoo Public Schools if they go to a university or community college in the state. It's been expanded to some private schools. Many cities came along and followed suit with similar programs, including Pittsburgh, your hometown. I'm wondering if you see these programs as the sort of things which move the needle significantly and do perhaps provide opportunities which have not been there in the past.
They do. they create wonderful opportunities. But one of the things that I think sort of undermined that effort is I'm not quite sure how things were designed in the Kalamazoo Promise, but here in Pittsburgh, they're for students that are part of the Pittsburgh public school system. And, you know, there are certain requirements that have to be met in order to be eligible, attendance and GPA. But what tends to undermine that, or what can undermine that, are the whole social mobility policies that are in place. So when you have gentrification taking place within the city, as people are moving back from the suburbs, the population within those public schools is increasing and is becoming more and more, is being filled with more and more people that have higher socioeconomic status. Migration is coming into the city. The poor African Americans are being pushed out of the city and so into districts that are poorer and poorer. And so those students don't benefit anymore from the Pittsburgh Promise or cannot benefit. So I see a sort of a diluting of that mission just by the whole migration of more affluent back into the city to improve the tax bases of cities like Pittsburgh, while the poor are being flushed out into public housing complexes outside of the city. And so those students don't are no longer in the Pittsburgh Public School District.
They're pushed out because they can no longer afford to live where they lived before people started moving back in?
Right. So as new development is taking place, you have the movement of some public housing units are being replaced with market housing and some subsidized housing. Well, the rate of market to subsidize is a high ratio. So you don't have the same number of people that once lived in public housing in those areas still living in that complex. They've been moved elsewhere, and so they no longer can attend those public schools because they live outside of the district. And so then you have a different population of students that can qualify for the promise.
Of course, part of the goal here, I suppose, is also to have more of a mix in the public schools of an urban area like Pittsburgh, perhaps more middle-class families moving back. So how do you achieve that mix where maybe some of those families that can be lured back to the city do come, and at the same time, the people are not forced out and don't have to move somewhere where they can't take advantage of the promise? How do we get to that place?
That's a good question, and I think it's one that needs to be seriously addressed. One of the things you have to look at is what a fair ratio of public of subsidized to market housing would be within any particular development. You also have to look at why it is the people are on subsidized housing to begin with. So jobs, is for the most part, is at the source of that, but then you have to look at the quality of jobs. So one of the issues we've been fighting here in Pittsburgh is we've been battling the largest employer in Western Pennsylvania, the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. And they, along with others like Walmart and fast food chains, have low wages. And so their wages that are quite substandard. And so people are not able to live in market rate apartments. They have to live in subsidized housing. UPMC, for example, has the largest number of people on public assistance in the state of Pennsylvania. So unless you provide high-quality jobs for people where they can afford to live in housing that is not substandard or not subsidized, then you're going to have people dependent on subsidized housing, which is determined based on where the government wants to track people. So it's a good question. I think it's a complex solution, but it's one that we have to certainly put a lot of attention to.
Reverend Welch, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for this opportunity.
The Reverend John C. Welch is chairman of the Gamaliel Foundation. He's also the vice president and dean of students at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. Reverend Welch will be the keynote speaker for this year's Isaac Banquet in Kalamazoo. You can find more details at WMUK.org. West Southwest airs Mondays and Thursdays. It can be heard at 9:30 in the morning and 3:30 in the afternoon both days. Links with more information, extended versions of interviews, and past programs can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.